are again.
Yes, we are.
Unfortunately, the episode we were going to do tonight turned into another meta. This is the first double meta we're ever going to have in a week. This episode publishes on Friday the 24th of March. It's episode 23.7, and this is all about recently passed artist Bernie Wrightson. Bernie Wrightson actually kind of has a very special place in both of our hearts. Yeah. We'll get into that in a moment, but kind of primary, this podcast kind of exists because of Bernie Wrightson, and not even in a roundabout way. So what happened was I was looking for a book, which was Neil Gaiman's Sandman, and I was told by Bob Camacho of the Nerds of Anarchy that there was a guy locally that had it and was selling. So I got in touch with that guy, and that guy happened to be Scott. And so when I went over to his house and we started talking about stuff that we liked, one of the things that we really kind of met on the minds of was Sandman. You know, I told him I was also on the hunt for some Wrightson art and old horror comics, and he clued in on that and was like, oh, cool. Swanthing's my favorite guy. And from then, we just started this really long conversation that probably could have been a podcast in and of itself.
And we realized we were both into horror and all kinds of neat stuff.
So then we just started the podcast. So anyway, I don't know. I'm talking a little bit quiet because my kids were kind of still on the cusp of sleep, but I don't need to talk quiet because I'm outside.
But you get in that mode, you know?
Yeah, so I can raise my voice a little bit. So if that first part sounded a little quiet and a little somber, then, you know, all the better for it. But anyway, I'm going to start off by cracking a beer, which is already cracked.
Let's go ahead and do that. I'll get the noise going for us.
We're going to toast to Mr. Wrightson.
Toast to Bernie, yes. Toast to Bernie, and a little just condolences sent out to Liz, his lovely wife, very sweet lady. She was by his side constantly.
And you know, maybe Liz will hear this episode and get comforted by how much he was loved by two random dudes in Houston here.
Right. Yeah. I sent her an email yesterday, just to let her know that I was thinking about him and everything, and you know, hoping that she was doing as best as could be expected at this time, you know. I know she's being overwhelmed just by people contacting her.
Right.
Because, you know, Bernie had a tremendous fan base.
You see all the tributes on Twitter and stuff from the different artists.
Yeah.
When you see an art, you know, when you see an artist's catalog, and you have a tendency to like turn pages and stuff, you don't dwell on the individual images so much. But with Wrightson, you kind of do, because they're so thoroughly detailed.
I was showing somebody the cover from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein he did in 83 yesterday, and he could not believe just how much intricate detail is in that picture. You know, and what was most amazing about it is, you know, it's a picture of a laboratory, all the devices you'd expect in a laboratory, and the Frankenstein monster and Dr. Frankenstein. The way he was able to keep everything in proportion throughout this entire picture, to where it just all just flowed, it's amazing. Yeah,
it's absolutely incredible, and how clean it is.
Yeah,
all of his white space is empty. There's no there's no pen strokes. There's no pencil strokes out of place. His white space is, it's almost as if he drew with the white space rather than the dark.
Right.
You know, and that was one of the things about his art that always struck me, is that he draws not with the darks, not with the shadows, but with the light.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses the shadows to accentuate the light. And just incredible work. So let's get into it. Bernie Wrightson.
Been drawing for a long time.
He was born on October 27th, 1948. Halloween baby. got his start. He was self-taught. He took a correspondence class and then just copied a lot of his idols. He got his first piece of fan art published in Warren's Creepy Magazine number 9 in June of 1966, which is one that I'm going to try to seek out, see if I can find that book and add it to my collection.
Right.
You know, as a little segue, I'm feeling a little bad now because I had some eBay stuff looking out for certain things, like, you know, his House of Mysteries and certain stuff that he had drawn, just not because of anything, but just because I'm a fan, and looking for good, you know, in good condition raw copies that I can look at the art. They're not slabbed. Of course, now all of those are going to shoot up in price for a while, but once they level out, I'm gonna pick them up. In 1966, the same year that he got his first publication in Creepy, he was working for the Baltimore Sun as an illustrator. Then he started working on his own stories. He showed a piece to editor Dick Giordano.
Giordano, yep.
I don't know why I can't say his name. His name's on so many of the
books
I own.
Yeah, so many covers. You were talking about that last episode.
And he got a freelance assignment, and his first professional story was The Man Who Murdered Himself in House of Mystery 179, and that would have been March to April of 1969. So almost 50 years ago, Bernie got his first published in DC Comics.
Yes.
From there, he collaborated with Lynn Wayne to create the Swamp Thing.
Yes.
Which we did a whole episode on the Swamp Thing not too long ago. Scott's spirit animal.
Yes, that is correct. It's all over my office. Yeah, him and Lynn, they came up with just House of Secrets 92, the opening segment of that particular issue was about Swamp Thing. And, you know, there was no background story at that time. It was just a monster that came to the rescue of a lady that was in trouble, and it hit something. It hit a nerve with people, and they wanted to see more of it. And a couple of years later, it blew up.
It's a tragic story, you know.
Yes.
And as another quick aside, Lynn Wayne has been in the hospital himself. He had to have some surgery. He's recovering.
Right.
But wish him well as well, because. Man, this one hit, man.
And it was so sad, man. The thing about it is, whenever he got sick again, when I had heard from Liz that he couldn't do interviews and everything in January, you know, everyone that I've known, when cancer comes back the second time,
it's short.
It's not going to take long. You know, it's sad to say, but that's how it's always been. You know, she said he was at a point where he wasn't cognizant anymore. He couldn't have a conversation anymore. You know, he'd sign his name. He couldn't draw. He wasn't him anymore. Mm.
So let's see here. Little quick thing on the Swamp Thing. It says here, with writer Lynn Wayne writes and co-created the muck creature Swamp Thing in House of Secrets 92 in July of 1971. It was a standalone horror story set in the Victorian era. Lynn Wayne later recounted how Wrightson became involved with the story. Bernie had just broken up with a girlfriend, and we were sitting in my car just talking about life, all the important things to do when you're 19 and 20 years old. And I said, you know, I just wrote a story that actually kind of feels like the way you feel right now. And I told him about Swamp Thing, and he says, man, I got to draw that. And history was made. So, he did his own scripts and artwork in Bad Time Stories from 1970 to 71, each story being drawn at a different medium: ink wash, tonal pencil drawings, duo shade paper, screen tones, along with traditional pen and ink and brushwork. And then he and Marv Wolfman co-created Destiny in Weird Mystery Tales number 1. It's the one issue that I have. It's an issue that I got, and I had a, I got it signed. So it's one of the prize of my collection. It is not in wonderful condition. It is in, well, it's wonderful condition for me. It is in well-read condition. And it's got his name scrawled across the front, and I couldn't be happier. I've got some little comic frames, but unfortunately, it's the old, the Silver Age still, whenever right. It's a little bit too wide for my frame.
Right.
So I can't display it yet until I get the right size frame. But that's one of my favorite books. And if you're listening and you're like, who the hell is Destiny? Well, I mentioned in our collector's issue that just recently came out how I'm a big fan of the Sandman. And when Gaiman took a bunch of old, retired, so to speak, characters and he put them into his Sandman series, right. Destiny was one of the Sandman's brothers. And so Destiny was actually a host of the old House of Mysteries or Weird Mystery Tales, where he'd introduce the story and then comment on it later on. He was right. The narrator. And it's kind of funny. I have a... I guess it's... How it's Secrets of the Haunted House or... Mm-hmm.
There's a Secrets of the Haunted House. There's
and it's funny because all of the other characters, so Cain and Abel and Madame Xanadu... Eve and Lucien, they're all making fun of Destiny for not having his own book because Weird Mystery Tales had awesome. Recently been canceled. But Destiny got elevated, and he's a very well-loved character now. Mm-hmm. So
I was last toy show that I did, I actually had some of my Sandman figures out there, and somebody, they were surprised to see that they had figures for each particular brother, each character. I was like, yeah, they got them all, actually. You can
find them. Do you have the little ones or the big ones?
The little ones.
Okay.
Little ones. Yep. Yep.
If you ever have a Destruction, okay. I think they made him, but he was extremely
Some
rare.
Of them were real hard to find, yep.
Anyway, don't want to get too far off the tangent here.
Yeah.
But the fun thing is, you know, if you're a comic fan and you're a fan of creators and creations, you just go down these rabbit holes.
It happens. 7 degrees of separation, man. You always can connect stuff.
So Wrightson had been asked by DC to handle the art for its revival of The Shadow, but he left the project early on when he realized he couldn't produce the necessary minimum number of pages on time because he was working on Swamp Thing.
Okay.
That was his baby. That was his love.
You know, another thing is, because I had this interview with me that he did back in the early 70s, and I love the answer to one of his questions is, how is your working speed? And he puts slow. Mm. And you can tell. I mean, his illustrations are very intricate. He takes his time with this stuff, you know, and this probably had another factor to do with it, is that he wasn't going to be able to finish it in time.
Absolutely. And even in his what you would call like normal pulp comic phase, he's still extremely detailed.
Oh yeah,
more so than a lot of others. And he's highly emulated. But you can tell the difference between a Wrightson and somebody who's attempting to look like Wrightson.
Right, usually the level of detail.
He's got like three times as many lines.
Yeah, the level of detail. It's you'd have to think he was a perfectionist to a certain degree with his illustrations.
In January of 74, he left DC to work at Warren, and he was working black and white horror comics, which was really his wheelhouse.
Right.
He did quite a bit of work, a lot of Edgar Allan Poe stuff, and a lot of just general, you know, scary stuff. And then...
just on that, that's another note. And just for you guys listening out there, I obtained a copy of a handwritten interview that Bernie did in the early 70s that I bought from someone. He essentially interviewed, sent him a bunch of questions, and he wrote them down, each question down with an answer underneath it. And it's funny because you can tell how he was getting aggravated with some of the questions, but one of the questions has to do with his feelings of Jim Warren from Warren Publishing. And apparently once he left, he was not happy with the direction that Creepy and Eerie and the other publications were taking. He didn't think that he thought they were trying to get too campy, too goofy, and he's more of a serious artist, I guess you could say, when it came to his horror.
Yeah. Well, then he went to work for National Lampoon magazine. But then after that, He spent 7 years drawing 50 pen and ink illustrations to an accompanying edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes, which that, you know, just on that note, just an old urban legend they have that I talked to Bernie about last year. It was always said that it took him a year and a half to finish his illustrations for Frankenstein. And somehow, after he finished it, he had an injury to his hand. He couldn't draw. He didn't draw for almost a year because his hand was injured. And the urban legend is the drawings were so detailed and just so much work that his hands
froze up.
Yeah, they froze up from drawing so much. But what actually happened is, according to him, he fell down. He caught himself with his right hand, and he sprained his hand, and that's why he wasn't able to draw. A lot of folks think that it was because of the illustrations, but it's actually he. But he told me, he said, the other story sounds a lot better.
Right.
So he kind of lets it go.
Then he went on, and the Captain Stern segment of the animated film Heavy Metal is based on a character he created for Heavy Metal magazine. He did quite a bit of work for Heavy Metal.
Yes, he did.
Then in 1983, he illustrated the comic book adaptation of Creepshow, which led him to lots of collaborations with Stephen King.
Yeah, him and Stephen King were very good friends.
I didn't even realize that was him that did Cycle of the Werewolf.
Yep.
I read, and I used to have, you know, obviously I don't have it now. I wish I did, but I had the original Cycle of the Werewolf. It was an illustrated... it was basically a graphic novel.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was full text with pictures.
Yeah, I have it at home.
And I remember just staring at those pictures. It was so much more frightening than anything they could do in the movie.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, he recently redid that whole portfolio at the end of last year. That was his last project, was redoing all those pictures from Cycle of the Werewolf. And for those that aren't aware, Cycle of the Werewolf, you might know better as the movie Silver Bullet by Stephen King.
Then he partnered with Jim Starlin for Heroes for Hope, a 1985 one-shot designed to make money for African famine relief and recovery. He also did a couple of others for the same purpose, a couple of other editions. Heroes Against Hunger. And probably my first, other than Cycle of the Werewolf, which I didn't realize was him, my first introduction to Bernie Wrightson was with Batman the Cult. So whenever I was first really collecting comics and getting into it was after the 89 Batman movie. Okay. And the Cult had just come out in graphic novel form. And there's the poster of that cover of Batman where he's all hunched over and just looking extremely...
I think I know the one you're talking about.
He looks quite evil. And that picture always struck me. I had to read this book. So I got that graphic novel... And it's quite violent for a Batman story, especially one from back that far back.
Right.
And it's the one where he kills.
Yeah.
He's broken, and he ends up killing people because he's drugged and he's out of his mind. But
the thing about it is, was it just that the drugs were allowing that dark side to come out that was had always been there?
Right. Know? But it was a departure for Batman, and so I always had that graphic novel. I still do, and then I found the original 4-part miniseries. I only had 3 of them, but I got Bernie to sign the first one.
Cool.
So that's another one that's kind of feather in my cap of this book that I'll never ever part with.
Right. You know, he says that Batman was one of his favorite characters to draw, out of everything. He loved Batman. He loved the story behind it and everything. So,
interesting how Batman and Swamp Thing get into it quite often.
Yeah.
So he did a lot of production designs. He worked on Ghostbusters. He worked on Serenity. He worked on Frankenstein Alive and a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, he's got a long, long bibliography. But I was just, you know, kind of going through all of this and just being like, man, you know, just the amount of work that one is able to create.
Right.
You know, when you're following your passion, when you love what you do, he he was also one of those guys who is a, he was a very outspoken advocate for the artist's rights. He realized that artists were getting screwed over. I mean, they were paid by the page, but then those pages were being sold for big money in galleries and at comic
conventions. They were giving up rights. They were giving rights to all their artwork.
And they were giving up rights, and so there was people making tremendous amounts of money off their art, and these artists weren't getting anything for it. So it was him and Neil Adams got together and worked, and so they started getting some of the artists' rights back. But
because I think, as Bernie says it, what they used to do is, essentially, they would give them a check for their work, and on the back would be a stamp saying they were giving up all rights to the artwork itself. And the only way they could cash that check was to agree to that,
right?
That thing. And Neil Adams brought that to his attorney and said, is this legal?
Yeah. Well, you've got that interview. Let's go ahead and just, I mean, we're
well,
here.
It's rough to read this thing. It's just because it's in his handwriting and everything, it's not the simplest thing to read. That's why I was kind of picking up some stuff here and there on it. Keep going. I'm going to find one of the better questions in here to go ahead and go through. Actually, I like this one a lot. The interview asked him what his favorite comic artist was. Who's your favorite comic artist? And he actually tells him, he goes, I can't pick just one. You know, there's no way. Give me a break. I can't name just one guy because all the others would feel slighted. My all-time favorites are... See Al Williamson, Joe Kubert, Jack Davis, Graham Ingalls, and about 700 more that never worked in comics. He had an appreciation for art. I mean, mm-hmm. And the thing about it is, if you look at the span of his work, he had a tremendous imagination because he could do everything from, you know, Captain Stern comedic stuff to the darkest horror you could find and mm-hmm. everything in between. I mean, to have an imagination that can just delve in that many different realms, it's impressive in its own. You know, most folks stick to superheroes, which he says in this interview he didn't really care for superheroes. You know, he didn't like the, you know, the caped crusader
right
type character, but he said it sells comic books.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
You know,
and I think, and I could be wrong, I don't want to speak for him, but the, you know, if you're working at a place like DC or Marvel, and you know, people are drawing this stuff, it's got to be fun to draw from time to time, whether you're, that's your passion or
right.
not. Everybody likes bubblegum, you know.
Yeah.
And if you can get drawn into a, you know, a Batman the Cult where you can make a character like Batman dark, you can kind of bring him into your own, make him yourself. Lots of awards. Let's see, he won the Shazam Award for Best Penciler in 1972 and 73 for Swamp Thing. He won the Shazam Award for Best Individual Story in 72 for Swamp Thing number 1. He received additional nominations, including for the Shazam for Best Inker in 73 for Swamp Thing, as well as that year's Shazam for Best Individual Story for A Clockwork Horror in Swamp Thing number 6. He won the 1974 Comic Fan Art Award for Favorite Pro Artist, and he was a nominee for the same award, then known as the Goethe Award in 73. He was a co-recipient of the Bob Clampett Humanitarian Award in 1986, along with Jim Starlin, for his work on Heroes for Hope. The following year, he received the Inkpot Award. He received the H.P. Lovecraft Award, also known as the Howie, at the 2007 H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival in Portland, Oregon. And he received the National Cartoonist Society Award in the category Comic Books for 2012 for Frankenstein Alive Alive. He was awarded the Inkwell Award Special Recognition Award in 2015 for his 45 plus years of work, including co-creating DC Comics Swamp Thing and Frankenstein.
You know, here's an interesting question from this interview that that you might like, especially the answer to. Interviewer asks, many people feel that your work in fanzines, such as Uncle Bill's Barrel, which I need to try to find, that I've never owned an issue of that, is superior to your work in comics. How do you feel about this? And his answer was, I agree. Uncle Bill's Barrel was a labor of love. I wrote it myself, and so became truly into it. In every aspect. I haven't been satisfied with anything I've done professionally, least of all the much talked about Night Smasher. There's always a breakdown between the writer's ideas and the artist's imagination. And that's one thing he puts up in here is, you know, artists always do better with their own creations, what they've written themselves. And some of the best work ever done in comics medium was by artists who wrote their own material. For example, Eisner's Spirit, Frazetta's, I can't make out which Frazetta he's talking about here, but it's one of his Frazetta works, and Starenko's Nick Fury. I haven't written anything myself yet professionally because I find it so damn hard to handle it. Into a straight story, seriously. Uncle Bill's Barrel started out as a horror story, a straight, creepy, crawly, boogie-woogie horror story, and you know what happened. I couldn't resist making it a caricature of itself, playing the whole thing for laughs. But back to the question, I don't think my work will ever be what I want it to be unless I go into humor. And then he does a little quip. If want to know if Mad Magazine might be hiring. So yeah, and that's, I could see, you know, where that would be very true in most artists' cases. You know, you're going to do your best work if you wrote it because you have more passion behind it.
Right.
You know, you're not just trying to put somebody else's ideas on paper. You got your own that you've evolved.
Absolutely. And I can see that if you, I don't know if you've ever seen or read many comic book scripts. Neil Gaiman is one.
A few of them.
Neil Gaiman is one who's, been kind enough to kind of let us peek behind the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
In one of his graphic novels, he actually has an excerpt from his scripts, and he really describes in detail. And he says, like, this is a little loose. It's a lot more formal normally, but this is how I communicate with my writers and, you know, with my illustrators and colorists. And it's quite detailed. He'll say, you know, it's morning, the sky is blue, you're looking, you know, it's a deep blue, you're looking at a close-up shot of the character with a long shot of the scenery behind him, there's a house behind, like, he's very detailed in what he wants to see on the page,
right?
And then he scripts it. He's like, character one says this, character says two says this, and then he'll, like, arrow down, he'll be like, next panel, and then he'll, like, in parentheses, he'll be like, top panel, you know, overlays second panel. And it's just like, as an artist, you're basically given a very quite step-by-step detailed instruction of exactly what the writer wants to see.
Yeah.
Now there's other methods, like you always hear about, like Stan Lee and Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, where and I don't know, there's a lot of controversy, but apparently Stan Lee would give, like, a very brief rundown. He'll say, the story is Spider-Man's doing this, he's doing that, he's doing these other things, the bad guy is the Scorpion, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jack Kirby would go home and just draw it all and script it all, and then Stan Lee would go in and take those pictures and finish writing the story on top of it. More of a collaboration,
right?
Which is bizarre that Stan Lee got all the credit, but
don't get me started on that one.
Well, no, but yeah, no, this is a completely different subject. But you can see somebody who's maybe as detailed and as passionate as Bernie, not liking those
constraints.
You know, yeah. The artist says draw Frankenstein. Well, I know what Frankenstein looks like. I'm on it, and. I can see where that would cause a
a slight riff.
And I don't even know if it would be as bad as if you've drawn it and then they come back and they're like, oh no, this was a daytime scene, and you're like,
"Urgh!" you put all your work behind it and you're thinking you know, like, you have to change everything. That would be frustrating, man.
This is in the day before, well, in a lot of his cases, and even fax machines, where, you know, you're at the board, you just draw it, you go home, you draw it, you bring it in, they're like, nope, that's not right. Or maybe that's right, but we're not going to pay you full because you forgot that it's a daytime scene, not a nighttime scene.
This isn't exactly what we wanted.
Hey, man, but he stayed with it. And he made a successful career.
That he did. And a career that he loved, you know, that he truly did what he was passionate about.
And I never got to meet him. He was at Comicpalooza here last year.
Last year, yeah.
And I couldn't go to that show. And shout out to Daniel Hoffman from Nerds of Anarchy. He was the one that actually grabbed my books and got them signed for me. Because, honestly, that was the only person at that entire show that I cared to see. But I was going to be out of town. I couldn't go.
Right.
So, you know, I chose my, you know, I didn't want to overload him. And I know how artists are. Well, I don't know how artists are. I know if I was an artist and some random dude showed up and he just had a big random stack of books for me to sign and didn't really have much to talk about, just please sign them so I can go flip them on eBay, I would be pretty pissed.
Right.
That's the reason Neil Gaiman doesn't do a lot of signings anymore. Or he does very personalized.
Yeah.
He'll be like, to Billy, on this date.
You know?
It's like, you're not gonna get all the money you think you're gonna get off of this. But for me, just getting the book signed, having them, you know, I've recently been thinking about kind of spring cleaning out my collection, kind of just not necessarily like getting rid of a bunch of stuff, but just kind of culling some of it, kind of streamlining it and stuff.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that if I end up with short box of all my best, those three are going to be in there.
Right.
You know, those are going to the girls.
And like a lot of the rights and stuff that I have, and the stuff that I love the most, it's not really worth that much to anybody except for me. You know, I got a signed copy of Captain Stern number one. Nobody probably wants that, but I love that book. His illustrations in the series Gargoyles, a little miniseries that he did for Marvel, those are badass. I got those at home. I'll show them to you sometime. And it was a comic book series of Frankenstein that he did that is really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
I got him to sign one of those for him. So he was great at Comicpalooza last year because he hadn't been in any shows in almost 2 years because he had been sick. Mm-hmm. And he had just started getting on the road again. So he was happy to sign anything. He was a...
Well, and Daniel said, because I sent... Weird Mystery number one.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he was excited to sign it. He was real happy. He pulled it out and was like looking through, and you know, he didn't draw the interiors, I don't think. He just created the character.
Mm-hmm.
With Marv Wolfman, but he was pointing out like, oh, you know, this and that and whatever, and he was all excited, like, you're proud of working with them on that book.
Right.
And so it just, you know, makes me happy that, you know, I didn't... It wasn't a Spider-Man number one sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, give me...
Well, I had my House of Secrets 92 I brought to him. But he was excited to see that one, too. He goes, oh, look at here. Yeah, I'm there with my Swamp Thing shirt on. My daughter's all excited. She's meeting the Swamp Thing guy and stuff. Yeah. It was really, really good to meet him.
Well, I'm looking at his bibliography here. And these are the ones that I have. I'm going to put all of these on my want list. All the stuff that... I mean... That's cool that he did something for, you know, Aquaman. I guess that's kind of neat. But, you know, I've got Batman 265. He did, in Batman, he did four different, five different covers. So, those are have to have.
Right.
I've got the Batman the Cult. I've got House of Secrets 106 signed. I've got Secrets of the Haunted House number 5. That's that one with that cool ass jack-o'-lantern.
Yeah,
it's like iconic. Yeah. I've got Swamp Thing number 4, number 9, and number 10.
Okay.
So I need to get those other 7. Here's one. He did a four-part miniseries with Jim Starlin called The Weird.
Okay.
Which is actually really, really good. And it's fully... He did the whole thing.
Okay.
And I've got that. You can get it in...
Cool.
You can get it in dollar bins, but it's an awesome story. He did a Wonder Woman Annual 7, and then I've got the Bernie Wrightson Master of the Macabre. That miniseries.
You gotta wonder if a lot of those one-offs that he did, you know, it was just like, hey, Jenkins is out sick. Can you cover this for us real quick?
Contract work.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, hey, like, that Aquaman, well, it looks like He did Aquaman Annual 4 in 1998. And then he did Wonder Woman number 7. They were both annuals in 1998. So okay. I wonder if it was just like he was doing a series of annual covers.
Yeah, may have been.
Because he also did Annual 22 in 1998. So he did covers for several books. So
okay.
Might be just something I have to look up and find. What all do you have on that list?
Oh, I got, let's see. Well, what's not on this list, which I was surprised at, was that Frankenstein series that I told you I got. I was looking for it, but that's not. But it's a three book series that I have. That and I also have House Secrets 92. I have 93 and 94. I got Plop number 1, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Plop series. Plop number 1, I got Kong the Untamed number 1. I have Swamp Thing 1 through 10. And also the second edition of Swamp Thing. And there's also Roots of Swamp Thing that he did with Alan.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Moore. Bernie Wrightson got in with him and did that one too. I got that one signed by Bernie. I got the Captain Stern 1 through 5. I have the Hellraiser number 1 that he did in 89. Gargoyle number 1, I have that cover. Got the Punisher Purgatory 1 through 4. I do have that set. Let's see, just flip the page.
Did you realize that he was on these when you got them?
Most of them, yeah.
Okay.
So I got all his heavy metal covers. I have all his creepy covers. See what else. I got the Tomb of Dracula 43. I do have that one. Werewolf by Night 35. Special edition of heavy metal. The Creepy and the Eerie, which I need to go back through and make sure. But I'm pretty sure I have all the covers. I made a point to go and find all the covers that he had done on those. The Frankenstein book, the hardcover from 83, and also Psycho the Werewolf. I got a copy of that too. So, plus tons of posters and everything else. That
your collection dwarfs mine. A lot of these I didn't even realize he was on.
People don't realize a lot of the stuff that he did. Like you guys out there might have heard him mention, Billy mentioned Ghostbusters a little while ago, but Bernie was involved with the creation of the librarian ghost right at the beginning of the movie, the very first ghost you see, and the guys are in the library in the basement. That's a Bernie Wrightson creation right there.
Did he just draw it, or did he just like?
He came up with the just the whole design of it.
Wow.
And if you look at it, it looks like a Bernie Wrightson drawing. I mean, it's very. Very reminiscent of the type of the style that he did. So
that's one of those again where you keep talking about how in the 80s, like, I mean, a movie called Ghostbusters has to have at least a little bit of scary, but that's the scariest ghost. Like,
oh yeah,
Zool's got nothing.
Oh yeah, the librarian ghost.
She's the scariest one.
Oh, definitely,
and,
by far. That's the one that gets you. I mean, it's the first one you see, and it's scary as hell. It scares the shit out of the guys on the show. That's for sure. We're going to do a little episode on the actual scariness of Ghostbusters, because there are some pretty good.
There's some good stuff scenes. In Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah. Just the storyline itself. There is no Dana, only Zool.
Well, you know, when you're talking about somebody's life and what they did in their life and the legacy that they have, Swamp Thing alone is something to be proud of. You know, a lot of people spend their entire lives trying to get that, like, one thing. You know, I'm one of them. I've got stories galore. You want that one thing.
Right.
If somebody likes or shares your podcast episode, you have that little bump and you're excited about it.
Right.
You're like, oh, my download rate went from, like, you know, 30 to 34. Like, what have I done? This is awesome. I'm at the big time now. But to have a legacy, to have a career that spans, and you have so well loved by so many... Well, you know, by so many people, and I don't want to necessarily say giants in the industry.
People in your industry itself.
That you're so very well respected and so well loved. And, you know, I was looking at Twitter the other day. I mean, I was kind of glued to it. I couldn't help it. But random people on Twitter, like, tweeting stuff, being like, I'd never heard of this guy before, but damn.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the day he died, like, I've never heard of him. But I miss him. You know, that was pretty heartwarming.
Well,
you know,
his career spans so much. Anybody that enjoys comic books or a lot of movies, they've been touched by Bernie some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I talked to him about with Swamp Thing was, you know, how he felt about the direction it took with the changes in the origin story and stuff. And he thought it was beautiful how long it had lasted, and how they were able to keep it fresh, keep it going. So he was fine with everything they were doing with the character.
it's a good character. And, you know, it's kind of funny how in those early things they kept, you know, he's like, oh, he's a muck-encrusted, you know, what was it, muck-encrusted blasphemy or something?
Yes, just, yeah, yeah.
It's like, and they kept talking, I was like, dude, stop insulting the guy, man. He's already been through enough without, like, his creators insulting him. But, you know.
Of course, there's always the man thing. I never got to ask him about the man thing, Swamp Thing controversy as far as which one came first, chicken or the egg, that type of thing. It, but I never got him to do my commission either. Mm. My Swamp Thing choking man thing out, which would have been great. I'll have to get somebody else to do that one for me.
We can find a man thing artist. And well, guys, I think that's going to probably wrap it up for this episode about Bernie Wrightson. I mean, as with any time, whenever somebody passes away, whether it's somebody you knew or, you know, didn't know but respected or whatever, it's always tough. And we just did a tribute episode for Bill Paxton.
This year's starting off just like last.
It's hitting like 2016, so let's hope that it kind of slows down. We're almost all the way through the first quarter. They're not dropping as quick, but let's hope that the Reaper stays his hand.
Right.
And
this is definitely one of the, like I said before, there's some celebrities or artists that have passed away I miss more than certain family members, and this is definitely one of them.
Let's drink another toast to Mr. Bernie Wrightson.
Mr. Bernie.
You're part of the green now, man.